You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the widespread destruction of our forests has stark similarities to the coronavirus pandemic. Our guest explains how trees are dying from invasive species and diseases that spread as people travel and transport things around the globe. And we'll learn about what can be done to stop it. Now, comedian Bill Cosby was released from prison last week after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court found that his right to due process was violated. In the majority ruling, the justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that statements Cosby made during testimony in a civil case regarding allegations of sexual assault were later used in a criminal trial. And this was after District Attorney Bill Castor said publicly that he would not prosecute prior to that civil case. It is a little bit confusing, and of course, we will learn the ins and outs. But the court argued that even though Castor never had a formal immunity agreement with Cosby, his public declaration that he would not pursue a criminal case, combined with the use of self-incriminating statements that Cosby made, amounted to basically a formal immunity agreement. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you think about last week's news? What questions do you have about the ruling? Do you agree or disagree with the decision? We want to hear why at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Here to help us understand this complicated case is Jody Madeira. She is a professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. Jody, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So we kind of gave an overview in our intro about what really kind of went down here with this decision, but can you just more expertly explain what happened?
Sure. The quick version is that you had this prosecutor named Bruce Castor, who in 2005 never reached a formal agreement with Cosby, but basically promised, you know, I'm not going to try you, and sent out a press release to that effect. Nothing was ever reduced to writing. He never got a judge to approve the prosecution's decision not to charge Cosby as Pennsylvania law requires. And then Cosby dished in depositions, four depositions, you know, gave lots of details about how he used drugs to then, you know, incapacitate women that he then, you know, perpetrated sexual assaults, sexual crimes upon. And, you know, in fact, then settled a case brought by Andrea Constand for, you know, millions of dollars in part on these depositions. And it's confusing because these depositions were given in a criminal context, but then Andrea Constand, you know, later used them in a civil case against Cosby. And of course, you know, that's what prompted Cosby to then settle the case.
So basically, kind of what it sounds like Bill Castor did was say, you know, we're not going to pursue this. But from what I've also read, he kind of opened the door for Constand to get justice in a civil case in some ways, but it feels like it kind of just didn't work. You know, how do we see cases like this happen? Like, is this a common thing for, you know, DAs to pursue? Is there something that I'm missing here?
No, I don't think you're missing something at all. I think this is very rare, very unusual. And in fact, you know, Constand had, of course, you know, brought these allegations to the prosecutor. The prosecutor had investigated for a month, and it's hard to know what or why he didn't believe that he had enough evidence, you know, but that's what the press release says. Usually these types of agreements are basically to get one person to flip on other potential criminal defendants, and they agree not to prosecute one person again so they can get evidence against, you know, people who may have been responsible for more serious offenses. But again, you know, it's interesting that this promise also bound, you know, Furman, Risa Vetri Furman, who of course reopened the Cosby investigation in 2015.
One of the things that has come up a lot, you know, legal writers, legal experts have said, we don't like how this happened, but basically the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made the right call that Cosby's due process was violated. So first, really basically, can you explain really what due process is?
Sure. And it's not so much a due process of law. I mean, so there's two things that are going on here. First of all, it's due process of law means that, you know, if you promise not to basically charge someone with a crime, you can't go back on that promise, you know. And of course, Cosby relied upon Castor's promise and just gave up all of these incriminating details that he never would have given up without this deal. But there's also, you know, I think just the basic principle of contract law, you know, that, and we sign contracts all the time, right? We, someone makes us an offer, we accept the offer, and usually there's consideration, you know, I may pay money for a certain right. Well, here the consideration was that Cosby gave up all of these incriminating details. And then later on, you know, he relied on that promise to his detriment. And this is a really key fact, I think, you know, to understand what happened in Commonwealth versus Cosby. When he actually gave those depositions with all of those incriminating details about how he treated women, that was the fact, you know, that was because of Castor's promise. That is what barred the prosecution from later, you know, sort of reneging on this deal and trying to prosecute him again.
We are talking to Jody Madeira right now. She is a professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and she's with us to talk about the recent release of Bill Cosby. Now, one thing we had briefly sort of touched on is that people might not have liked the decision, but that legally it might have been the right call. I guess in the court of public opinion for legal scholars, how do you, I guess, drive the point home that you may not, this might not feel right, maybe morally or otherwise, but technically is right in the eyes of the law?
Yes. And I think, you know, you look upon like the Cosby case as one tree in a forest, right? And the forest, in order for the forest to be healthy and safe, you know, it has to have certain qualities. It has to have good soil. It has to have, you know, temperate conditions. It has to have the right plants growing in that soil. Has to have the right animals that will then, you know, help this forest eco structure maintain itself. And if one tree starts dying, you know, if one tree gets this, you know, really horrible disease, it could spread to other trees. And before you know it, you wouldn't have a forest. And that might be not the best metaphor, but I think, you know, if you fail to have justice in one case, it can undermine legal accountability in many cases. And there have been a lot of people who say, well, now women are not going to bring their cases forward, you know, because they're going to be afraid that, you know, the same result will obtain. Well, Constand actually, you know, got a civil settlement of millions of dollars. Justice was had in one sphere of the law, you know, and in another, Cosby was convicted. This is actually nothing to do with whether or not he is innocent. It is everything to do with really the mistake that a subsequent prosecutor made, you know, and to be truthful, I don't think the law in Pennsylvania was that ironed out about how far one prosecutor's promise, you know, could burden another prosecutor if it wasn't reduced to writing and never approved by a judge.
And I want to hit on something that you just alluded to, which is this decision, even though probably many people had this reaction of, oh gosh, like he's free, that must mean that he's not guilty. This doesn't exonerate him, correct?
That is correct. And, you know, in fact, that's one of the most frustrating things, you know, and I'm frustrated by this decision as much as anyone else. It doesn't taste very good, even though I know it's, you know, the right decision legally. You know, Cosby's been sort of crowing about this in the media, about this, you know, proving his innocence and things like that. It has nothing to do with his innocence. And in fact, I would very much doubt, you know, from the 59 other women out there, plus Constand, that he is in fact innocent. You know, he himself has told us that he is not. So I wish he would sort of stay in his lane and be more honest.
We are talking about the release of Bill Cosby with Jody Madeira. She's a professor at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to Cosby being released? Do you think the court did the right thing? What questions do you have about the legality of this decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we will continue this conversation in just a minute here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I am talking right now to Indiana University law professor Jody Madeira about the release of Bill Cosby after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said his right to due process was violated. A bit of a recap. Bill Cosby was in prison for sexually assaulting a number of women throughout his career. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And one thing you said right before we went to the break was that, you know, there are 59 other women who allege that Bill Cosby assaulted them and that, you know, he drugged them all under the guise of, you know, professional, you know, getting ahead, that kind of thing. And, you know, it's hard for people to even report that, you know, they have experienced a sexual assault, whether it be rape or otherwise. You know, we kind of touched on it, but does this have a chilling effect on people moving forward?
I believe it could if it's not accurately understood. You know, accurately understood, although it's not satisfying and it actually might, you know, sort of make our stomachs turn, the law has to apply equally to everyone in order for us to believe that the law is legitimate and that it will protect us if we ever need it to. But at the same time, you know, we hear sound bites. We believe that if he's released, you know, the very first thing we think of is that, oh, there must be something about the evidence that is problematic. There must be something about, you know, someone recanted their testimony or whatever. We're not used to these like legal technicalities. And frankly, we're not very good at figuring them out. And, you know, it took the lawyers and the judges years here to work them out in this case. How do we expect, you know, lay people just listening or reading news stories to understand this? And so I think it could have a chilling effect, you know, just when we've seen some of the rewards of the Me Too movement start to pay dividends.
So we've basically gone through, I don't want to call it a technicality that got Cosby out of prison, but it was a confusing, almost unique case that, you know, his due process was violated because the path of convicting him, you know, fell because a district attorney said that they weren't going to prosecute him. He thought that that was a promise. And then in his civil suit basically said, yeah, I did all of this. You know, one victim got some amount of justice in the civil court, as you said earlier. Could there be any steps moving forward to maybe prosecute him again, or, you know, for any other reason, is this kind of the end of the line?
Well, it could be the end of the line for the Cosby case, but the Pennsylvania, you know, district attorney can always appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And of course, it's up to them whether they're going to take that case. I do think, though, that as the majority of legal experts agree, I concur, you know, that the Supreme Court would actually come to the same conclusion here. But this is actually just a one in a million case. This is one of those cases they teach in law school because it is so rare and so unique. And, you know, it's sort of, I believe, was meant by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to send a message to prosecutors. And that's why they actually refused to let the prosecution try Cosby again, which was a possibility. They could have let, you know, the prosecution try him again, but without the evidence from the civil trial. In other words, without the evidence from Cosby's depositions that he gave in reliance on the promise, but they didn't do that.
So not to speculate too much, but even if this were to go to a criminal case again, even discounting the evidence that we heard in the civil case, you know, would Cosby's lawyers basically have a leg to stand on and say, hey, any jury that we pick is going to be biased here? Is that a possibility?
It is, but I don't think you could absolutely, you know, bar any prosecution of him based on that argument, because, of course, you know, the fact that he's notorious doesn't allow him to escape justice in another case brought by, you know, if another woman brought charges. The interesting fact, though, too, is that most of the 59 other women's claims are barred because of statutes of limitations. And that is also, again, frustrating because, you know, we have these caps on how long a prosecutor has to bring a case. In fact, you know, Furman brought the charges against Cosby days before the statutes of limitations expired in the Constand case in 2015. And so it's often a race against the clock.
We have about 20 seconds left. What do you think, what will we see maybe over the next couple of weeks with this?
I think we'll see, you know, some good legal analyses come out. We'll see some comments, you know, by victims who have brought charges and maybe been in similar situations where maybe the evidence wasn't there, you know. And I hope that we see more support from the survivor community, the sex assault survivor community, reach out to support Constand, and also to let, you know, the world know that Cosby is not innocent. This is just a technicality.
Jody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Jody Madeira is a professor and the co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. She joined us today to talk about Bill Cosby's release from prison, as she said, on a legal technicality and what might happen next. Now, if you've ever been to an orchestra concert on the 4th of July, you have likely heard this song as the finale of the performance. That is Russian composer Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Well, it's the last bit of it anyway. It's complete with triumphant cannon fire, as you're hearing in the background, and celebratory bells. And it feels really patriotic, and it is, just not necessarily for anything having to do with the United States, or the 4th of July, for that matter. So just how did this song become such a part of the American repertoire? WPR's Robin Washington has traced its July 4th performances back to what may be the first one by the Boston Pops. He spoke with Pops conductor Keith Lockhart last week about how it came about.
So I think I know my history, and I'm not talking about any revision or cancel culture, whatever they want to call it, but there's universal agreement in the way the War of 1812 is and was taught, which is that the Russians and the British were on one side and the French and the Americans on the other. Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture is celebrating the defeat of the French in Russia, isn't it?
Yes, well, you know, I suppose I should answer that question with a question. And why does any tradition become a tradition? it is true. Your history is more or less correct there. The 1812 Overture of Tchaikovsky was written in the 1880s to celebrate a Russian victory over Napoleon's troops in that war of 1812. It has nothing to do with the American victory over the British in our own war of 1812. But nonetheless, it has become really nationwide a proud part of most people's 4th of July celebrations.
Mm-hmm. We won't get into historical nitpicking here, but I'm not sure it's entirely nothing to do. We were allies, so, you know, I think we rooted for one side or the other. So why did the Boston Pops start playing it for the 4th of July?
Well, therein lies the story. And I'm proud to say the Boston Pops has been, you know, a leader and a tradition setter in so many ways. Why not in that way as well? It dates back to, I believe, 1974. When Boston businessman and entrepreneur philanthropist David Mugar who was a good friend of Arthur Fiedler, the conductor of the Boston Pops at that time. The two of them actually were both kind of firebugs. They loved getting together following the Citizens Band radio and going to meet the fire trucks where they were fighting various fires. And one time, Fiedler was a little distressed because the attendance on the Esplanade, where we have offered free concerts to the people of Boston since 1929, was beginning to tail off a little bit. And he said, we really need to revitalize this 4th of July program. And David Mugar said, what's that piece by Tchaikovsky that has the cannons and the bells in it? and Fiedler said, well, that's the 1812 Overture. And he said, I think if you do that, people are going to love it. And so they started doing it. People did love it. They enlisted local army reserves to fire the howitzers out over the Charles River. And they enlisted the local churches that ring the Esplanade to ring their bells at the appropriate time. And this was first seen by the whole country in 1976 in the televised bicentennial concert. And it kind of took off. And now it would be almost impossible for us to imagine doing a 4th of July concert without it.
So you could say it spread like wildfire, or about cannon fire, right?
Yeah, it spread like cannon fire, yes. But, you know, the thing is, and people have for many years harumphed that this piece is not about anything that we necessarily celebrate on the 4th of July. But I think the answer to that is, you know, why does anything become a tradition? It becomes a tradition because people expect it, because it sets off certain things with people, excitement or whatever. And it's part of the celebration now. I think what's in a name, I suppose, at the end of the day. The audience loves it. It has spread to pretty much every orchestra, big and small, around the country by this point. And so I think, like so many things, you know, this is a country of assimilation. We bring people in, we take their cultures, we take their traditions and customs, and we make them our own. And I think this is just another example of cultural assimilation on a broad American basis.
All right. So no one's ever accused you of being Benedict Arnold's or a Russian spy.
Not that I know of. People have accused me of many things.
Well, if you'll indulge me once more on the historical vein, I don't know if you've ever studied a map of Wisconsin, but if you look at the top, you see the Upper Peninsula, which for some reason belongs to Michigan instead of Wisconsin. There is a reason. Congress gave it to them. There was something called the Toledo War that Ohio and Michigan were actually going to fight over. And the deal was to give the Upper Peninsula to Michigan. But there's no geographic reason for this, sitting on top of Wisconsin.
So that's how the Upper Peninsula, I always wondered that it makes a very odd shaped map. And I always wondered about that. Thank you.
Well, good. I just enlisted you on our side. And so if Wisconsin ever decides once and for all to invade it and take it back, is there a battle hymn you could recommend?
Well, I think the 1812 Overture has already proven its versatility. So, you know, it's either that or On Wisconsin. So,
all right. We won't argue with that.
That was WPR's Robin Washington speaking with Keith Lockhart, the conductor of the Boston Pops, about how the 1812 Overture became a 4th of July musical standard. Don't recommend invading the Upper Peninsula, but if they wanted to join Wisconsin, hey, we wouldn't turn it down. Now, coming up, we'll learn about the troubling emergence of invasive species and their impact on forests in a way our next guest argues is really similar to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's coming up after the news. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6, it's 1A+. When Dessa's not singing, writing, or rapping, she's keeping busy with a new show on the BBC, an upcoming drama, and releasing music named after the host of Fresh Air. Host Jen White talks to Dessa tonight at 6 on 1A+. Now, our next guest says the widespread destruction of our forests has stark similarities to the coronavirus pandemic. That's because trees are dying from invasive species and diseases that spread as people travel and transport things around the globe. Gabriel Popkin is an independent journalist. He writes about science and the environment. He also spent some time here at UW-Madison. Popkin's recent piece in the New York Times is called Invasive Insects and Diseases Are Killing Our Forests. He spoke with WPR host Keely Boltina this spring.
The ways plagues make trees sick and make people sick are different. Can you help us understand how that works, why they're different?
It's a great question. Obviously, humans and trees are very different. We breathe in oxygen. We have lungs. So that seems to be how COVID-19, which is, I know, on everybody's mind, that's how it gets to us. Trees are different, but they definitely still have plagues. And these plagues can be caused by a variety of different kinds of organisms, anything from fungi to insects to even these things called water molds.
And yet, you're clear that you see parallels between the insects and the diseases that spread among trees and the contagious diseases that we deal with as human beings. So how are they similar?
Both humans and trees, we sort of live in an environment with a lot of different things that are always trying to attack us. Like there were all these cold viruses and flu viruses floating around. Sometimes we get sick, but you know, our immune systems are pretty good at handling those things. Similarly, trees have to deal with all kinds of things, fungi, bacteria, insects trying to eat them, attack them. And trees have an immune system. It doesn't exactly work like ours. Trees can produce hundreds of different chemical compounds that help them defend themselves against disease and insects. And that's why, you know, you might have a tree that gets attacked. Sometimes you'll even see trees get defoliated, but they just come back the next year because they can handle the usual sorts of organisms in their environment. But when either humans or trees, you know, encounter an organism that's very different from anything we've ever seen, that's when real problems can occur. Trees, let's say trees that are live in North America, they have not seen insects or pathogens that might live in Europe or Asia, because these continents have been separated for millions of years, and trees in that time have evolutionarily diverged, and each species has its sort of own set of organisms that attack it or feed on it. So when one of these organisms is transported to a new continent, it finds all these trees that have had no opportunity to evolve defenses. This didn't really happen very much before 1492 because fungi, insects can't really cross oceans on their own very often. But once humans started crossing oceans, they took organisms with them. And this includes both kind of accidental introductions and also intentional introductions. As soon as that started happening, that's when trees on different continents started meeting new diseases and new insects that often they had absolutely no defenses against. Columbus himself did intentionally bring livestock and I think certain plants from Europe to the New World, or what they call the New World. But as far as I'm aware, the first major tree plague outbreak occurred in the early 1900s, which was chestnut blight. So even though species were being transported across oceans for a long time, the sort of level of global trade that we see today is a more recent phenomenon, where you really just have huge numbers of ships transporting things from continent to continent, you know, including people intentionally import plants. Like they say, hey, Japan has some nice hemlock trees, or, you know, Europe has this different kind of chestnut tree. Like, let's bring it over here so we can put it in our gardens. And that's plant trade is what, you know, started the introduction of these forest pests. Mm-hmm.
We're learning from Gabriel Popkin. He's a journalist who focuses on science and society, and we're talking about threats to America's forest. This is the Ideas Network. And Gabriel, you brought up hemlocks. In the early 1950s, scientists found this insect from Japan that threatened American hemlock trees. What happened?
From what I've read, this insect was first discovered in a botanical garden in the Richmond, Virginia area in the early 1950s. But people think it actually was there probably for several decades before that. And these botanical gardens, you know, sort of owned by wealthy people, these folks really wanted plants from all around the world. This was a really popular thing to do in the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, was to go around the world and collect plants, bring them to the U.S., grow them. It was sort of a status symbol. I think it was part of, you could say, part of American imperialism as well. And nobody thought about the consequences. So with hemlocks, these hemlocks were imported, I believe, from Japan. They grew probably in a benign seeming way. And then this insect was discovered, but nobody knew what it was. Even after it was discovered, nobody really took action until sometime around in the 1970s, maybe 80s, when suddenly people started seeing hemlocks dying. So that's when the alarms were sounded. But by that time, this insect is all over the landscape. It spreads by, you know, birds can spread it, wind can spread it. There's just, at that point, there was no stopping it. It was way too far gone for anyone to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak.
Is this a problem in Wisconsin?
Not yet. The last I heard, the hemlock woolly adelgid had not been detected in Wisconsin. Now, it certainly could be a problem because Wisconsin has a lot of hemlock trees. Hemlock loves cool, shady, moist areas, and northern Wisconsin in particular has a lot of those. If you go up to the North Woods, there's hemlock everywhere. The Menominee Reservation in northern Wisconsin, the Menominee tribe are globally recognized for their forest management. And one thing they do is that they really keep hemlock on the landscape. So there's a lot of reasons to be worried about the hemlock woolly adelgid. The good news for Wisconsin is that Wisconsin has cold winters, and it seems that the adelgid can't really survive below about negative 40. So as long as winters keep getting down to that temperature, that should really keep the adelgid at bay. But climate change is warming up winters very rapidly, and the warmer winters get, the less protection there is against hemlock woolly adelgid. And the other thing I would note is that the adelgid has recently been detected in Michigan, right across Lake Michigan. So it's, you know, not hard to imagine the adelgid hopping over the lake somehow or another and landing in Wisconsin.
And you just mentioned the issue of climate. Invasive species and diseases, when they kill trees, they actually contribute to our warming climate, right?
That's correct. The hemlock woolly adelgid is absolutely deadly. The hemlock species we have in the eastern U.S. really have no defenses against the adelgid. And so as soon as those trees are dead, they start decomposing. And when trees decompose, a large fraction of the carbon that is stored in bark, in wood, in roots, and so on, will end up in the atmosphere. Now, I think it's important to note that this doesn't happen overnight. I often go hiking in Shenandoah National Park, and I see, you know, large hemlock stumps, or I mean, whole trees even, that have probably been dead for 30 years and are still standing or lying on the ground or lying across streams. So it's not like a forest fire where all that carbon goes up in a day. It's going to be a long process, but ultimately a lot of that carbon will end up in the atmosphere.
That's Gabriel Popkin talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. They continue this conversation about invasive insects and diseases ravaging our forests. Popkin recently wrote a piece about this for the New York Times. We'll hear the rest of their conversation coming up in just a moment on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. From hemlocks and ash to chestnut and elm trees, contagious diseases are decimating America's forests. Our guest argues we should reconsider how we travel, ship, and import plants if we expect to keep forests safe and healthy. WPR host Keely Boltina talked about that with independent science journalist Gabriel Popkin in the spring. Here's the rest of their conversation.
My family tries to get out and walk around, and I kid you not, in 2 days, I have had 3 socially distanced conversations with people out in their yards about all of the ash trees that we've had to take down because of the emerald ash borer. I mean, people see this in their communities as well as forests. Is it fair to say that this threat is real for everybody, even if you're living in a fourth-floor apartment in the middle of a city, that we should be worried about these things?
Oh, absolutely. Ash is one of those trees that has been planted throughout American cities because it's a great tree. It's beautiful. Some ash species grow very quickly, provides really nice shade. And I guess probably people like it because it doesn't drop huge nuts or acorns or anything like that. In fact, I lived in Wisconsin about a decade ago, and in the backyard of the house where I lived was a beautiful old white ash tree that provided amazing shade and amazing fall color. You know, I would be afraid to revisit that tree because I imagine it's probably gone by now. Yeah, the emerald ash borer has cost cities billions and billions of dollars in tree removal costs. Ash trees are also very important ecologically. And one thing about ash is that there are many species of it in North America, and they each sort of specialize in different environments. Green ash is a real wetland tree. It loves to be near water, and it grows a lot in streams and wetlands. And so when those trees die, those streams and rivers, wetlands, are much less protected from nutrients coming in, say, from nearby farm fields. And it really can change the entire ecosystem. That's also true for black ash, which grows kind of farther north, like in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. On the other hand, white ash is more of an upland tree, and you might find that in the mountains and as an important part of those forests. And as you mentioned, in cities, both green and white ash have been planted a lot. And yeah, that's definitely going to take cities a while to recover from the emerald ash borer.
We planted a lot of them. Are these ash trees that are under attack native to Wisconsin, or is this an example of that tree trade that you talked about that went wrong?
No, they're native trees. We have, I believe, 16 native species of ash tree in the United States, and all 16 are believed to be vulnerable to the emerald ash borer.
And there's an additional cultural aspect to this when it comes to tribes in Wisconsin.
That's right. Tribes in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest own pretty sizable chunks of forest, and these forests often have ash trees. And there's a traditional use of ash trees for really making a lot of different kinds of crafts, but the one that I think people that is best known is basket making. The black ash has these, the bark sort of comes in strips, and it's quite easy to separate the strips from one another. I actually saw this done a couple of years ago. And you can, in a day, you can cut down a tree, separate the bark into strips, and have a basket. And this was a very important kind of traditional use of ash. It almost died out from the Midwest, but it's actually being revived. There's some great basket makers, one in particular who I met on the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin. And she tells me that so far she hasn't seen the ash borer where she lives, but she's very worried about it. And in fact, is already sort of making plans to figure out how to keep her basket making business. I mean, it's a real money making business going after emerald ash borer comes through.
Gabriel Popkin wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times arguing that the United States is not prepared for diseases and invasive insects poised to decimate our forests. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And even beyond basket making, I mean, this isn't just an ethical conundrum or an environmental conversation. Invasive species and diseases, they threaten people's livelihoods, their money.
That's right. There was a recent study that came out that put the cost of all invasive species globally at over $1 trillion. Now, this is over several decades, but anytime you're talking about $1 trillion, that's, you know, that's big money. These things are definitely taking a chunk out of the global economy. There's no question about that.
We've talked about the fact that transporting plants can be a problem because it spreads invasive species, but they can also like hitch a ride on packing material and get from overseas to here and then attack.
Exactly. And that's actually what happened with the emerald ash borer. It's thought to have come in on wood pallets. You know, I'm sure everyone's seen goods shipped on wood pallets. This is a very common way to pack goods onto these large container ships. The emerald ash borer first showed up in the Detroit suburbs. Detroit obviously has a port, and the thinking is that it just hitched a ride on some wood packing material. Nobody even thought about this potential problem. And then by the time the ash borer was discovered, it was already way too late. It was widespread in the environment. Some of the earlier plagues came, like chestnut blight and hemlock woolly adelgid, came in on live plants. And so the USDA recognized that and really ratcheted down on the kinds of plants that could be imported. And I think it's been a while since a major new plague was imported on live plants, not to say it couldn't still happen. But it turns out when you sort of close one pathway, then often another pathway opens up. And so this pathway for insects to come in on wood that hasn't been properly treated has been a big one. Here in the East Coast, there's also this new thing, the spotted lanternfly. People think that came in on landscaping stone. So some landscaping company imported some stone from another country, and just, you know, this weird insect that nobody had ever thought about just hitched a ride. So that's a kind of a newer area of concern. And, you know, it's not the only one.
This is where you draw another parallel between trees and people in this pandemic, because we knew that something could come. Experts have shouted that the world was not ready for a pandemic, even though it was a real possibility. You say that translates to the situation with our woodlands.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a group of environmentalists, advocates who've been for quite a while sort of calling on the government to do more to prevent the introduction of these forest pests. And obviously they're competing with a lot of people who want the government to do more of a lot of different things. But, you know, I think they have kind of a strong argument that every day, thousands, if not millions of containers enter the U.S. Carrying all kinds of goods, and only a small fraction of these are inspected. Now, I do think it's important to give credit. Government agencies have gotten a lot smarter about how they do this. They sort of have this risk rubric where they can kind of make decisions about which containers to inspect, and they've gotten stricter when they do find a forest pest, let's say on a improperly treated wood pallet, they punish the company. So that didn't used to be the case. Things have gotten better, but you know, the folks I talk to are still concerned that there are many ways that new forest pests could enter the country.
Solving deforestation or preventing plagues in trees feels like a really big burden, something that somebody who has a lot of power has to handle. Are there things that we can do as individuals to stop this from happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've sort of been discussing, a lot of the forest plagues that we've seen have come in on plants from overseas. And there's always been this idea in landscaping that, you know, our native plants here in North America are not good enough. We need to bring in stuff from elsewhere. And lately, there's been more of a movement toward using native plants. And there's many reasons to use native plants. But in my opinion, one of the big ones is they're not going to bring in a new insect or disease because they've been here essentially forever. And the insects and diseases that feed on them are well adapted. They're well adapted to kind of coexist together. So choose native plants over imported plants when you're doing your landscaping. And the other thing I would note is that it's become really popular to import kind of exotic plants as house plants. I think this is kind of a big hot new trend right now. And that's not necessarily a very well-regulated industry. You can go online and, you know, click a button and order all kinds of weird plants, as one expert put it to me, and just have them shipped to you. You know, think carefully about where these plants are coming from, if they may pose a risk to plants here, and if you really need them, or maybe, you know, think about buying instead a native plant from your local garden center. And just one more potential route of introduction is in airplane luggage. People go overseas and see something you like and you want to bring it home. Well, maybe think twice about doing that because you don't know what else could be hitchhiking on that plant that you love so much.
How concerned are you about the future of our forests?
Well, I worry a lot because, you know, it looks like our forests are full of trees, and they are, but in a place like Wisconsin, there are not that many different types of trees or genuses, as biologists would put it. The forests are really kind of dominated by a few big genuses like oak, maple, obviously. We mentioned the hemlock and the ash, and there's a handful of others. And each of these pests seems to specialize on a particular genus. So if you lose the hemlock and the ash, and if you could imagine a few more pests coming in that might take out maple and oak, you wouldn't actually have a whole lot left. So I am quite worried about this.
Gabriel, thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Gabriel Popkin. He spoke with WPR host Keely Boltina. Popkin is an independent journalist. He writes about science and the environment. He also spent some time at UW-Madison. Popkin's recent piece in the New York Times is called Invasive Insects and Diseases Are Killing Our Forests. You can read it for yourself. We've set up a link online at WPR.org/centraltime. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show, tomorrow at 8. Shootings did not stop during the pandemic. In fact, more people were killed by guns in 2020 than any other year in the last two decades. Guest host Lee Rayburn learns why there's been such an uptick in gun violence and what can be done about it. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then, how has the pandemic affected your love life? We talk to a relationship expert to learn more. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson, and this is Central Time.